Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Cherry Smiley. She's an indigenous feminist activist and artist from the Thompson and Navajo Nations and an accomplished public speaker on sexualized violence against indigenous women and girls. She's a founding member of the unfunded group Indigenous Women Against the Sex Industry, IWASI, and current campaign coordinator for the Feminist Alliance for International Action's Campaign of Solidarity with Aboriginal Women, a campaign focused on Canada's missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on this program.
Thank you so much, Derek, for inviting me to be here, and thank you for your work as well.
Oh, thank you. So, tell me about the missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. That is something that perhaps a lot of people don't know about, especially not in Canada, and more people should.
It's true. I mean, the issue is really, it's quite huge, so I'll try and break it down kind of the best I can. So over the past, I guess, really kind of 20 to 30 years, there's been rumblings in different communities across Canada, Aboriginal communities, that, you know, women are going missing. So these are our aunties, our mothers, our sisters, daughters. And so over that time frame, but especially really in the last kind of decade, a variety of organizations. So this is including family members, Aboriginal women's organizations, women's organizations, you know, kind of the national Aboriginal organizations we have as well. But mostly, I would say, coming really from a grassroots level. So you're looking at, you know, family members, Aboriginal women, who've really started to make a lot of noise about the murders and disappearances. So what happened was in 2010, so I guess 4 years ago now, the Native Women's Association of Canada. So in Canada, we have five national Aboriginal organizations, and only one of them is an Aboriginal women's organization. So that's the Native Women's Association of Canada, or NWAC, released this report, and they had done this research into the murders and disappearances, and they had come up with a number of 582 missing and murdered Aboriginal women. I believe it was over a 30-year period. And this was groundbreaking because this is the first time that anybody had actually done research and began looking at numbers. And because of the difficulty in terms of police often not taking reports when women have been reported missing, or police misidentifying the race or not including the race, NWAC was somewhat limited in the scope of the research. But still, they came out with this number of 582, which to some people may not sound like that many women. But because the Aboriginal population of Canada is disproportionate, you know, much smaller than the non-Native population, 582 is equivalent to approximately, I think it's either 18 or 19,000 people in the non-Native population. So that's a significant proportion of our women and girls that are going missing and being murdered. And the other thing that was really significant in that research that they did was how many of these women were actually girls when they went missing and were murdered. So you're looking at, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old teenage girls who are being, you know, violated and murdered. A lot of those murders were and continue to remain unsolved. And same with the disappearances. So this kind of happened in 2010, and you know, since then and before then, the kind of momentum and the awareness on this issue has been really increasing. In 2014, yes, this year, the RCMP, so this is the RCMP themselves, who are oftentimes, you know, not responding to police reports and things like that. So the RCMP themselves, which is the Canadian police, did their own investigation, and they came up with a number of 1,182 over that same 30-year period. So that's almost double the NWAC number. And I'm just going to double check my number here. But it was over 1,100 anyways. Missing and murdered Aboriginal women. So that's, you know, if we were to, you know, equivalent that to the non-Native population, that's almost double that 18 or 19,000 equivalent in the non-native population. So, and what's partially so disturbing is that the list keeps growing. So this isn't a problem that we're looking at that happened in the past, you know, and this was awful and, you know, people say sorry or whatever, right? This kind of, not really meaningful kind of reaction that we've had to things like residential schools and, you know, things that supposedly in Canada. So so this continues to happen. And Aboriginal women and girls are continuing to go missing and being murdered in disproportionate numbers. We're looking at a human rights crisis in Canada.
So what... I mean, I'm almost not even sure what to ask because it kind of boggles my mind. This is not like, you know, seven women from one community who could have been killed by one person. I mean, this is not some sort of, we can't easily point a finger at one crazy person like the what was his name? Picton or the pig mm-hmm. farmer who mm-hmm. murdered however many women. This is obviously a larger, why don't I just shut up and ask you, so what's happening?
Well, I mean, it's true. This isn't the work of one crazy man or one isolated incident, right? This is, the most kind of grave injustices and violations on a systemic level. So it's a result of so many factors, but one of those has definitely been the colonial devaluation of Aboriginal women and girls since, you know, contact or invasion or however you want to, you know, frame that. So I know from my story, I was raised very closely, raised very much so by my maternal grandmother. And I hear these stories all the time about, you know, she calls them the old people. So she'll say, oh, you know, the old people, you know, they used to do things like this. And, you know, women were treated like this and women, you know, were valued and, you know, had leadership positions. And really the, not to say that pre-contact everything was perfect, because of course it wasn't, but these systemic inequalities that we're dealing with today didn't exist pre-contact. So I have this kind of sense of what things were like. The way that I think about it is, you know, and that many other Aboriginal women do, of course, is once the white settlers came over, men realized that these women, our Aboriginal women and girls, had positions of power and leadership, and we were valued and treated with respect. And there was a systemic construction of these really horrible racist ideas about Aboriginal women as being kind of this Indian princess or these dirty squaws, right? So we kind of get constructed in these really non-human ways. And once you kind of frame somebody as being not human, it becomes very easy to then violate them, right? And that was partially... for better access to our lands and our resources, right? So we need to get it, and our women often say we're the hearts of the nation. So we need to get at the heart of the nation, and we need to attack these Aboriginal people where it hurts, and that's going to be at their women and their girls, so that we can systemically, try to get rid of them so we can access their lands and resources.
When you said the Indian princess or the dirty squaw, is that, I'm just thinking of the sort of pornographic trope of either the virgin, well, which is also the Christian trope, of either the virgin or the whore. And are those the equivalent of that?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I mean, I kind of call it the Indian equivalent of the kind of the Madonna or the whore. And that itself is a symptom of patriarchy. So we're not just, you know, it becomes very hard to separate all these really oppressive systems at play, right? So yes, we are talking about colonialism and racism, but that is so intertwined with patriarchy and the ways that all women get treated and violated by men and male privilege in a patriarchal system, but how that plays out in very particular ways and particular types of, exceptionally harmful, very violent, very degrading. So it's like violence plus that gets committed against Aboriginal women and girls simply for the fact that we are Aboriginal women and girls.
So that provides sort of a really quick overview of some of the political or social or cultural drives that are pushing these disappearances and murders. But what, and I realize we're talking about more than 1,100 women, so we have 1,100 different circumstances, but what is actually happening? Is this happening all over Canada, from the East Coast to the West Coast and from the South to the North, and or is it more localized? Is this are a lot of the missing women who have the cases have been solved, are those stranger violations, or are they known to the people? And what do we actually know about what's physically happening to all these women? What are some of the commonalities?
Sure. So, I mean, the greatest commonality of all is that these women and girls are Aboriginal, and that's, what a sad statement to say that in itself becomes, a risk factor in terms of being violated or being killed or raped or whatever. So, it is happening. It is across country. We are looking, north to south, east to west. So it's happening in smaller communities. It's happening in big cities. The situation, the world that Aboriginal women and girls live in today is one where, and I've heard this said before, that oftentimes Aboriginal girls, and I know myself growing up, it's not a matter of if I get raped, it's when I get raped. And it's this, you're living in this climate that where it, you're at risk of kind of death or disappearance. My grandmother, I'm very fortunate to be able to do this work in many different places. And whenever I go somewhere, my grandmother will keep calling my phone when I get there. And she'll keep calling until I pick up. And that's because my grandmother is afraid that one of these times I'm not going to pick up and I'm not going to make it to my destination. So it's not as if class makes a difference. So whether you have a lot of money or you don't, whether you're in university or, you're being prostituted on the street, none of those factors really matter. You're still at risk of violence by men. And that's the other really common factor, right? And unfortunately, it's one that doesn't get talked about enough. I find in the media framing oftentimes is we talk about the murders and disappearances, but we talk about the disappearances as if these women and girls just kind of disappeared into thin air. Like one day they were there and the next day they weren't. So it's really important that we talk about who's doing what to who. And in this case, it's men who are violating and murdering and raping Aboriginal women and girls. And it's definitely, you're at increased risk as an Aboriginal woman and girl of stranger violence. So that's much more commonplace in terms of, we see the Highway of Tears in northern British Columbia. I live currently on unceded Coast Salish territories in Vancouver. So in my province, in the northern area, there's a highway along there where they've had a number of women and girls, but mostly Aboriginal women and girls, go missing along this particular stretch of highway. And that's a result of stranger violence. But the other half of that becomes a little bit more difficult to talk about is the fact that oftentimes our own men in our own community, so our fathers, husbands, boyfriends, are oftentimes violating, incesting, battering women in their own communities. And that's the as a result of that implementation of patriarchy into our communities, and that little benefit, that very small benefit that Aboriginal men get from a patriarchy, right? So the violence starts very young, oftentimes, and it just doesn't stop. So it's devastating.
So and you don't have to do this if you don't want, but I'm thinking that well, I want to tell a real quick story, which is that something that I have said at several talks to talk about male privilege is that I was on tour one time and ended up in my planes were late. And since you travel a lot doing talks, I know you know how unromantic touring is. Yeah, so I, you know, my plane gets into Moline, Illinois at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I catch a shuttle to my hotel, and the nearest place I can eat, I get into the hotel maybe 1:30, and the nearest place I can eat is a Denny's. It's about a mile down a deserted highway, and I haven't eaten all day because the planes are all late. You know, I'm just in airports. And so I start walking to the Denny's, and I walk past this empty McDonald's, and there's a white van parked in there. And as I walk by the van, they start up. And I get kind of scared. And at that point, I'll stop and I'll ask the audience, so especially you women, at that point, would you have run back to the room? And all the women in the audience say, "Are you kidding? I get in at 1:30 in the morning. I am not walking down a deserted highway."
Right.
And, you know, as opposed to as a guy, it's like I didn't get worried until a van starts up like 3 feet from me.
Mm.
And so I'm just wondering. And so my question after all this little story is, can you give? Okay, there's two levels here. One is being a woman, and the other is being an Aboriginal woman in this society. The question is, what is it like to be you? And so can you give? I mean, you've said one example of your grandmother calls you concerned every time you fly anywhere, which I think probably does not happen to your typical CEO who travels somewhere.
Right. Their grandmas, yeah, probably not.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, they're probably not checking in with their grandmas. That's true.
Yeah, so just can you differentiate for me what it's like to be a woman facing that? And then in addition, just like on day-to-day, like an example like I just gave with, you know, I'm hungry and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, so I'm going to walk to Denny's. And you might simply have to stay hungry all night. And then also what it's like to be an Aboriginal woman as opposed to a woman from settler society in this culture.
So I know for myself, it's really actually, so I, one time I was doing these presentations and I was invited to go to these communities, these reserves, reservations in British Columbia and, you know, talk about sexual violence and those types of things. And I often find that those types of talks, they get constructed as if I need to go and you know, give these women safety tips, right? Like I need to teach women how to be safe. And the fact of the matter is that Aboriginal women and girls grow up, we already know that we're not safe. Like we don't need to be taught that. So you grow up with this, well, I did anyways, fear that kind of, you know, manifests itself in a number of different ways. And I find that, you know, as a girl growing up in a home where there was a lot of violence, you know, I'm going out and I'm doing these speaking engagements and I'm talking about these things, but there is this, you know, there's an unsurety in myself. That's kind of always kind of there, right? And that the kind of larger society has this messaging for Aboriginal women. And when it comes, especially to the murders and disappearances, and that messaging is that you don't matter. So it doesn't matter, you know, I don't like to brag at all, and I very rarely bring it up, but I have a master's degree, and, you know, I've done some things in my life. But that messaging is so strong that tells me that I don't matter and what I think doesn't matter, and that I don't even that I should be thankful, kind of, that I have this privilege of being alive. So it manifests itself in ways like, ways where I'm have this kind of constant fear is what it is, right? And this unsurety in myself. And, when I'm back home in Vancouver, and we have an area in Vancouver called the Downtown East Side, and that's where Picton was most active. So it's a very poor neighborhood. The poverty and the prostitution and drug use and alcoholism is very visible in this neighborhood. I remember having a discussion one time with this woman, and she was telling me, oh, it's very much a community there, and that the media frames it, and it does, as being this really terrible place where people are all on drugs and doing crazy things. And and she's like, it's really great when I go down there. And she was this young white woman who was in school, and I go down there and I'm talking to people, and it's great, and they're people. And and I was like, when I go down there, I'm getting propositioned for sex on every block. Like, pimps are trying to recruit me, men are trying to buy me. Like, that's my experience of walking down that street. So it's hard, I guess is the reality of it. And the way that it, especially doing this work, and being very fortunate to be able to do this work, I'm doing this work. But at the same time, when I'm talking about these issues, I'm thinking about my own family, right? So I'm thinking about my own family, my own community, my sisters, my cousins, and all the struggles that they're dealing with on a daily basis, right? Trying to survive the poverty, the violence, all those types of things, right? So it does become very, very difficult, because the women that I'm talking about, all these women have faces for me, right? Like, they're my family. So the ways that it kind of manifests itself, like in the messaging, let alone the fear, right? The myself, I don't go out at night. At night, I have been the victim of a stranger attack. I have been, the victim of, male violence in my family. So, there's a heightened sense of awareness, I think. But then the way that also transcribed itself in my life as, as a person who's working and who's going to school, and that constant messaging that you have no value, you're not worth it, you're not even worth being alive. That is to me that one's almost trickier to deal with, and because it's just not so obvious.
I'm really sorry that you have to go through that. It sounds really hard. I'm thinking. So let's go a slightly different direction for a minute. And what has been it's good, I guess, that the RCMP revised the numbers up. It's bad that they had to revise them up, but it's good that the RCMP seems that they're providing some sort of they're not whitewashing the number, at least there. What has been the relationship between how has it been to try to work with the RCMP or local police to try to get some justice or at least resolution for some of these women?
Well, so I've just looked it up as well. So the number that they came out was 1,181. So I think that was off by one originally. Is the number that their report states. And I mean, even that number is potentially low, because they also recognize that police have not taken reports when they should have, or misidentified the victim's race or not recorded it. So. So even that number could be low in terms of the reality of the situation. So the police, I worked for many years as a full-time and then as a relief worker at a transition house and at a rape crisis center. So, you know, across the board, police don't take violence against women seriously. So whether you're Aboriginal or not, if it's male violence against women, you know, the outcome, the excuses, and, you know, well, we can't do anything, we can't arrest him, et cetera, et cetera. So, so across the board, the situation is not good. And the police, what's difficult as well in these circumstances, especially with Aboriginal women and girls, is that oftentimes the police are perpetrating the violence. You know, police officers or judges, we've had that situation in Northern BC as well, you know, harming and violating and raping and sexually assaulting Aboriginal women and girls. So you have that kind of additional, add that power onto male privilege, and the situation is not good. So in Vancouver especially, I find with the messaging is kind of interesting, because for the past little while, the Vancouver Police Department has basically had a mostly kind of hands-off approach to prostitution. So they aren't, you know, necessarily arresting the women as much, but they definitely aren't arresting the Johns, and they aren't targeting the Johns. So, you know, the faith, I think, in the police, and the fear around calling the police, and then that messaging, right, that the police give, which is essentially, you know, we're going to allow pimps and Johns to purchase women. So, you know, basically you're disposable in life. And then when you do go missing or get murdered, we're not going to investigate. So you're disposable in death. Makes it really hard for Aboriginal women to want to use the police, and when they do, to have a good experience using the police. So I think policing is a huge part of that system and a huge part of the problem.
So what? I mean, there's a larger. I want to come back to the police in a minute, but what? Since the police are not providing effective protection, and in many cases are actually perpetrating, what, in addition to attempting to get the police to do the right thing, what do women do, and what do how do you get justice or resolution or anything?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think about it a lot. And, you know, I think sometimes there can be a push for, community, kind of the community taking it on, right? And themselves, as opposed to looking toward the police for assistance. And I know that women, like, I've, you know, seen it myself. And before that, you know, story, women have always done that. You know, women have always tried to keep each other safe, and, women going, go to your cousin's house, right? If you're getting, your husband or your boyfriend is beating you up, you take off and you go to your cousin's house or your auntie's house or whatever. And, women kind of forming these networks, right, to really try and support each other and, helping each other out, with a few bucks, maybe, you need some money because you got to get out or whatever, right? So women have always, we've always put our lives on the line for each other. We've always had ways and strategies to try and deal with the violence, right, when the police and the government are not. So, but I don't think that giving up on the police is the way to go. I do think that that we really do need to hold the police accountable. I know, again, working at the transition house, there's policy, there is actual policy in play. So on paper, it looks all right. In practice, definitely not so great. But I don't think that means that we should give up on holding them accountable to the policies that are working. And to trying to get the police to actually work in the interest of women. Like I really do believe in, I mean, it will be obviously a very slow change, very, very slow change, but I do believe in the ability of men to, you know, the idea of the police is so connected to, you know, masculinity and patriarchy and, you know, the idea of men as protectors and things like that. So I do believe that we can transform those fundamental ideas and get to a place where, you know, men are taking, police are taking violence against women seriously, you know, both as a reflection of our society, but also as a way to reaffirm those values. And I do think that we can get there. It's not going to be easy for certain, but I mean, if we look at, you know, policing now, right, like property crimes, whoa, like that's a huge deal, right? Like, you know, you get robbed, like the police are going to show up, right? So so it is possible, I think, for them to pay attention to this issue. And I know that, you know, other women have other opinions, but this is the way that I think that we should go.
So this is reminding me of something that I've mentioned before on this radio program, and also I think it's just really important. I have this friend, Charlotte Watson, who used to run – excuse me, I'm going to cough. Excuse me. I have this friend, Charlotte Watson, who used to run the domestic violence program for the state of New York, and she also ran a battered women's shelter, my sister's place, and now is a court advocate for women in the state of New York. And she's great. I just love her. She's I've told this story a lot, that she basically asks every man she sees what it'll take for men to stop beating on women. And she's completely relentless. You know, you get in a taxi cab with her and she'll ask the taxi driver, you know, it's like, don't get on a subway with this woman. It's just insane. You know, she's great. And she has a soft East Texas drawl, you know, so she seems very non-imposing. And then it's like, just surprises every guy by saying, so what's it going to take for men to stop beating on women? And anyway, her answer is that it will take other men doing it, that women can't do it by themselves. And she thinks it will partly take men saying, you know, I heard you call your girlfriend a bitch, so I'm not going to play basketball with you anymore. And what do you think about that?
Well, I think she's right.
It's kind of silly for me to even ask that. I'm sorry, because it's like, okay, so basically somebody is beating the crap out of you. What's it going to take for them to stop? Well, it's going to take them stopping.
Right. And I think, you know, the consequences, you know, they can be, you know, less harsh. Like, I'm not going to play with you now. Or, you know, more serious. But I do think that men do have a very important role to play. And sometimes I think sometimes I think they get it wrong. And sometimes I think they kind of want to come in, you know, and call themselves a feminist and, you know, be part of this and kind of take over, right? This work that women have been doing, when really they need to be focusing on themselves, masculinity. They need to be talking with young boys. Like, they need to be redefining masculinity, like as a concept as it relates to their lives. And more men need to be doing that and working with other men and speaking to other men. And just stopping.
You know, something that I've been thinking about a lot privately, but I haven't talked about ever publicly before, is, do you remember the Jodi Arias case in Arizona a couple years ago? She was a woman who killed her boyfriend. And the point is that there was a it was happening at the same time that the Oscar Pistorius trial started. Mm-hmm. And what really struck me was the complete difference in how they were covered, that Jodi Arias was, according to the media, just this terrible, horrible woman who, she's a demon. She's, you know, they really dehumanized her. And I don't know enough about her to defend her or not. My whole point is just the media coverage. And on the other hand, Oscar Pistorius, the Olympic guy who shot and murdered his girlfriend, there was actually a headline that he was a fallen hero.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that in many ways they were both just this sort of manifestation of the woman hatred that is really endemic in this culture. That if a guy does it, if a guy murders a woman, it's like, well, you know, boys will be boys and he screwed up. Yeah. Too bad for him because he can't be in the Olympics anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if a woman kills a man, then she's a demon, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Which, that puts women in such a tough position because if you don't do anything, then people are, well, why did you stay with him? Why did you stay with him, right? If she's trying to get out, but she can't, you know, the police aren't helping, you know, she has no money, you know, she's got a few kids, whatever, right? So she does nothing and she's blamed and then she gets fed up and you know, when she does something and then she gets blamed. So it's like there's no way for women to move when it's situated like that, right? When we get constructed like that. So it's really, really, really hard. And then, of course, you know, men oftentimes when they're committing acts like this, it's, you know, as if he's this singular man, right? As if this isn't like a structural systemic problem, right? It's, you know, well, he accidentally shot her or whatever, as opposed to this is, you know, how many rapes really are happening today? Like how many murders are happening today? How many beatings, like how many wives are getting, you know, or girlfriends are getting, you know, the crap kicked out of them right now. Right. So, it just gets really decontextualized and presented as these kind of individual crimes, right. As opposed to, you know, women hating misogyny.
So we have about, 7 or 8 minutes left, and I guess one question I would like to ask is if you could, if suddenly tomorrow Canada put you in charge of a commission that was going to stop violence against women and especially against Aboriginal women in Canada. Okay, you can't make industrial civilization disappear and you can't make the settlers go away entirely.
So okay.
we'll take that off the table for now. That you can do that next week. Okay, so in this week, like, what would you do? What would you? I guess I'm sort of asking policy. You know, one thing is obviously you just said you'd make the police do their jobs.
Right.
So what would you do if you were in charge of some sort of, if you were given some power to some significant political and, you know, define power however you want here. I don't care. If you were given some power to, and I know you got power already, but leave that aside. You know, you're given some political power. What would you do? What sort of policies would you? What would you want to see changed to have sort of an immediate decrease of the violence against women and against especially Aboriginal women?
One of the things. Obviously, yes. Like make the police do their job. And so criminalize the men. And, you know, kind of like your friend said earlier, when I'm talking about criminalization, I don't necessarily mean throw them all in prison and lock them away forever. Like I'm not a big fan of prisons. I think they're really harmful. But to have some consequences, right? So whether that those are social consequences, political consequences, you know, criminal consequences, whatever. For men who are doing these types of things. The other thing that I would really address is, two other things really, but they're related, is the hypersexualization of girls and young girls. And I think, you know, our girls are growing up in a culture that tells them from birth that that sex is really all they have and their sexuality is all they have. And I do think that images have power, and I think the world that we live in sexualizes girls from the get-go when they're being bombarded with these images, and young boys are being taught through those same really, you know, so we're talking, you know, popular media portrayals of women, right? So advertising, you know, music videos, those types of things are teaching girls that they're only good for sex and teaching boys that girls are only good for sex. So really I would kind of clamp down on that. as well as, you know, I am an abolitionist and work for the abolition of prostitution. So, and I think that is such a, it's very related to the issue of the murders and disappearances, and really implement implement the Swedish model here in Canada. We're working, we have like baby steps towards that, but we're not quite there yet. So that as well as a guaranteed livable income, so that, you know, women have the ability to leave when they need to leave. I mean, in Canada, unfortunately, there's been such a clampdown on women's organizations. So much of the funding for women's organizations has been cut severely. I think we need to, you know, in the moment, right? I mean, originally, you know, I'd like to work toward a world where we don't have money and, you know, this capitalist system is not what's running everything. But to have, so that women have means and the ability to leave when they need to leave is, you know, is important. But yeah, a step back from that, you know, men need to stop and they need to have consequences. That's a good question. I've never been asked that question before.
I think a couple things. One is that you know from my books that my father is extremely violent, and he raped my mother, my sister, and me. My brother had epilepsy from blows to the head, broke my sister's arm, and one of the reasons my mom stayed with him is because it's exactly what you said about the economic situation, that she, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, what was she going to do? You know, she couldn't, there weren't alternatives. There weren't even battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s for the most part. And so that whole question of economic independence is so huge. And then the other thing I was going to mention has to do with media portrayals. Two things, actually. One of them is Gail Dines has this great line about basically patriarchy. You can sum up the socialization. I'm going to use the S word instead of the F word. basically, patriarchy is socializes men to say screw you and socializes women to say screw me. And that I was thinking about that when you said that about media portrayals. And then the other thing has to do with something that's just been a hobby horse of mine for years. It pisses me off that so often you'll see rape scenes in movies where the woman starts by fighting the guy off, and by the end of the scene, she's pulling him close. And you see this just time and time again. It's a pornographic trope that is in mainstream film all the time. It's V for Vendetta has a scene like that where he tortures the woman, and the first thing he does after she says after she gets out of he's put her in prison, first thing she says to him is, "I love you." Mm-hmm. It's just nuts. Or Dr. Zhivago, where Evgrab is raping Laura. And I always contrast that with the rape scenes in a rape scene in Deliverance, where it's a guy getting raped, and it's one of the most horrific scenes in movie history. Mm-hmm. And so that's something, you know, we didn't ask me, but one of the things I would do is change those media portrayals immediately.
Yeah. So that we get to say, not even that we get to say no, but that the question isn't even on the table in the first place. Right.
I'm sorry. Can you say it again?
To change the media portrayals, not just so that women get to say no, but that men aren't demanding sex in the first place.
Right.
I think is hugely important. And one of the other things that I would add to that as well, especially in the cases of our Aboriginal women and girls, is we really do need to have access to our lands are an inalienable right. We don't get to give that away in a treaty. That is our right to be caretakers of our lands, as well as our cultures and our languages. I know that I've worked with a lot of women and girls who really need to. I need that. That's what sustains me. And I know that, you know, women who are struggling, that really helps with their ability to get that tape that plays over and over again, that you're worthless, you're worthless, you're worthless. It stops that tape, right? To be able to reconnect. And part of that, you know, is also related to, you know, the environmental destruction. So we need to have our lands in order to find out who we are and where we come from. So the way that we are the land, if I can say it in that way. So we need those things, to be able, so that if we do have the economic freedom to leave, that we do that because we, you know, we value ourselves, and the world values us as well, right?
The one thing I know is that the land never tells you that you're worthless.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to say something?
Oh, no.
So we have like 1 minute left. So if you could have, what do you want the listeners to this interview? What do you want them to take away from it? And what do you want them to do?
Well, I want them to know that there is always hope. And I know sometimes I feel like, it's too big, it's too complex. But it's actually not. It's actually quite simple. And so I want people to feel hopeful and that we can do this. And to do, there's a number of things they can do. But one of the things that they can do is to go to the website for the Feminist Alliance for International Action. So the website is fafia/afi.org. Just Google it. Feminist Alliance for International Action, and sign on to our solidarity network. So we're building this network to get people more aware of the murders and disappearances and to support the human rights of Aboriginal women and girls.
So thank you so much for being on the program, and I would like to thank people for listening. My guest today has been Cherry Smiley. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.